We made this.
Welcome to the Starlight Ballroom. Hey!
Welcome to Shipwrecked and Comatose, the podcast about Red Dwarf on the We Made This podcast network. My name is Mark Adams, and we are working our way through Series 7 of Red Dwarf. With me at this time is my co-host, Kurt North. Hello, Kurt.
Hello. I feel fucking horrendous.
You always feel horrendous.
What's going on with me at the moment, right? So the last two episodes that we covered, I ended up finding out after the recording, about 20 minutes later, that I had COVID, and we've recorded, behind the scenes, folks, we've recorded this like 3 weeks later and I'm feeling fucking horrendous. And the first time ever that I get to say swear words twice before anyone else.
I mean, I do say fuck quite a lot. No, we fucking don't.
We never swear.
That's Colin, by the way. Hello, Colin. He's our guest host for the next two episodes.
Morning. You all right?
So we are looking at Series 7, Episode 3, Our Rob or Ross, or Robber Ross. A Robber Ross? I'm going to go with a Robber Ross.
Ouroboros.
Ouroboros. Yes.
And there's a reason why I'm confident about this, which we'll talk about shortly.
Okay. This was broadcast on the 31st of January, 1997. So I'm going to have to correct myself for what I said on the first two episodes. I wasn't at university yet. I went to university in September, 1997. So I was doing my A-levels when Series 7 was released.
Because you're old.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but it, like I said in the first two episodes, it does change my experience of Red Dwarf because, well, I was an adult, I was 18, and it was very different seeing this for the first time as a grown-up compared to all the other series. Was that a similar experience for you, Colin?
Yeah, so I wasn't a grown-up. Yeah, I was 97, I was 15.
Are you grown up now?
Fair point, I'm still not a grown up. Neither grown or an adult. But no, yeah, obviously there was the, I assume you've talked about in the last couple of episodes, that there was a 3-year gap, was it?
4 years.
Between Series 6 and 7? 4 years, which, when you're that age, is a significant, nearly a third of my life it had been between the previous series and this one. So whereas when Series 6 was shown, I was sort of 11 and I was absolutely obsessed with it and it was the most important thing in the world. Did you say this was September that this would broadcast?
January 97.
January 97. Okay, I hadn't quite got a girlfriend yet. But later that year I did.
But you wanted one by the sounds of things.
Yes, very much so at that point. There were other things I was a little bit more interested in. So I watched this series when it was broadcast, but it wasn't one where I got the videos or even taped it and rewatched it loads of times at the time. I can remember my dad being quite disappointed with this series. And I think that rubbed off on me a little bit with me thinking, it must be not as good because my dad thinks it's not as good. It isn't as good, but I think it is better than I thought it was. I have enjoyed rewatching it. I wasn't massively looking forward to getting to Series 7. And then when I've actually got round to it and watched it, there is still a lot of stuff that I've laughed at in there.
I think that was my experience too, but it was more that I was disappointed with Series 7 because it wasn't as good as Series 6. And frankly, Series 6 of Red Dwarf is one of the greatest series of science fiction and or
anything.
Well, yeah, science fiction or sitcom that has ever existed.
Yeah.
And I was always going to be disappointed by something that was slightly less good than that.
Yeah.
And I think that we're going to see that Series 7 is grossly underrated, actually.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Have the previous two episodes gone? Because obviously I've not heard them yet. Have they been fairly positive? No, not as much, though.
I was more positive than Kurt.
we found Grumpy Kurt.
Oh, excellent. I'll look forward to hearing that, then. Obviously, everyone listening has already heard that over the last few weeks. And so have I when this is going out.
So there's another cold open, and it starts with a box with our Rob or Ross put under a pool table, and there's a teleporty noise. A man walks in and finds it. He shows it to the bar staff and they discuss the bad spelling of our Rob or Ross and what will become of the boy.
Do you know who the baby is?
Isn't it Danny John-Jules' kid?
It's Danny John-Jules' nephew. It's Alexander John-Jules. Yeah, they'd originally got a different baby in, but the baby that they got in had much too dark skin tone to convincingly be Lister as a baby. So right, Danny John-Jules said, my nephew's just been born, he'll do. And volunteered him. And he came down and did it. Frank, the bloke that finds him under the table, he's better known, it's Gary Bleasdale is the actor, better known as Gary, one of the Scousers out of Harry Enfield, which surprised me that one of the Scousers in Harry Enfield was actually from Liverpool.
I haven't seen that in years. I wonder how... I don't think it can be offence. Maybe it's offensive. It is quite stereotypy, isn't it?
You'd better ask from Liverpool whether it's...
Yeah.
Let's not talk about my parentage, but let's carry on.
I mean, I love the city of Liverpool, and I remember as a kid that stereotype was really, really strong. And it is absolute bullshit. I work a lot in Liverpool. I really love Liverpool. It's an incredibly cool city. The docks area is fucking great. And, you know, all the jokes, bollocks. Liverpool's a lovely city with lovely people. So, yeah, maybe that fucking Harry Enfield thing was shit, actually, thinking about it.
Although, as a result of that particular sketch with the stereotype of the curly permed hair and the little goatee beard thing, there was a bloke that lived in the village where I lived growing up that I used to see walking his dog past my house all the time. And me and my dad both independently had decided he was a Scouser. And then we heard him talk one day and he'd got a really strong Polesworth accent. And it was really jarring.
Let's move on and talk about Red Dwarf again. The date of birth of Lister was the 26th of November, 2155.
That's the date of finding his box, not date of birth. He was already born.
Yes, but you know what I'm getting at. 2155 is the year that Lister was a baby.
Is that the first time we've had an actual set date given?
Well, I was going to say I haven't been asked to actually look at the research and all the, I'm an enlightened 21st century guy and all the other stuff that's contradictory. But Series 7 was full of really grating contradictions to the point where I didn't research this one. Did either of you bother?
I had a quick look, and there was the quote about being a 23rd century guy. There's also, I think, there's some reference somewhere to Red Dwarf being launched in later on in this century, in about 30 years' time. Obviously way too early. I think this, as far as I'm aware, this is the first time there's an actual set date where it gives you the date and the month and the year. So it really sort of ties it into, you know.
And I think that goes back to what I've said in the previous weeks, Mark. I think the having Doug wanting to like produce more of a comedy drama than an actual sitcom, it feels to me like he's wanting to build a world. He wants to build worlds. You know, he wants to like say, right, this is the day.
Yeah,
this is what's happening. You know, have these. We'll talk about the actual events happening here. The pacing of the show slows down. The kind of the drama aspects really kind of come to fruition.
Yeah,
the jokes become less. And we'll see this. Like I've said before, you know, not so much maybe in Series 8, but you know, we'll see this in Back to Earth and we'll see this in The Promised Land. The stuff that's like, this is more his kind of vibe of like building that comedy drama rather than just being a sitcom.
It's closer in tone to the books, I think, because the books are a bit darker and more serious.
Yeah. Yeah, good observation. I agree. So there's no theme tune. And we've talked about how there are extended versions. The extended version does. And Lister is brushing his teeth and shaving at the same time. After plucking his nose hair with tongs, he sneezes out his tooth cap. Crichton arrives and they discuss getting it fixed. He says it'll take 30 minutes to sort out an adhesive, so Lister decides to use wood glue instead. Crichton has found a pink frilly dressing gown to adapt to new clothing for him, but Lister decides to wear it anyway now. And then Lister uses dental floss, but it gets stuck into the wood glue he's put into his teeth. Cat arrives and says there's something on the long-range scanner.
Cat's got a baseball glove and a baseball that he's playing with as well, which I think was a callback to a few series ago where there was just one randomly lying around in the shop.
Well, that's interesting because in the first episode of Series 7, the extended version, he's playing baseball with Crichton's eyes.
Ah.
He's got the hat, he's got the gloves in with Crichton's thing. So whether or not they've had this baseball like glove just hanging around the set.
Yeah.
Potentially because they've used it twice. Obviously, we're not necessarily talking about the extended version here, but the those moments like seem to correlate. The reason why the cap tooth is written into the script is because it actually did happen to Craig Charles. He tried to super glue a broken cap back onto his tooth, and it went horribly.
Fuck's sake!
That was included in there for the reason.
It's a mean-ass in-joke, basically.
Yeah.
Excellent.
So there was one thing that, it's not ick, but I didn't like it. I thought it was mean-spirited. Just a random dig at women that work in Oxfam. Pick on Tories rather than old ladies that help you out.
It seemed needlessly punching down, that, I thought.
Yeah.
Which, it's better, you know, previously they've been better than that a lot of the time. There's a few bits like that in the next couple of episodes where I've thought,
yeah, and that's the thing, isn't it? Left-wing comedy is funny because you punch up, whereas right-wing comedy is grim because you punch down. And this just felt a little bit mean-spirited.
Yeah.
So the thing on the long-range scanner is a power surge that's caused a temporal rip. They can't escape, so they go for the Eye of the Storm.
And it's made of really bad CGI.
This is going to be a theme. Each time we get a new person on, a new guest, it's going to be, isn't the CGI shit? Because yes, it is.
Yes. There's model work later on that's great, but that bit of CGI really, really is bad.
It's not quite as bad as the complete mood killer of the Saturn's ring in the last episode where with all the Ace Rimmers, because that could have been really, really poignant but was actively ruined by the bad CGI.
Quite mean shit,
whereas I don't think it's that bad here.
No, it's amusingly bad. I to be honest, I love the bit where Starbug just sort of shakes about all over the place. That is, it looks hilarious, and I think that's meant to. So,
and what's really sad is the CGI makes this look older and shitter than Series 5 and Series 6.
The incidental music in that bit is really bad as well. There's a really weird bit of music when Starbug gets sort of sucked into it.
That's something that's recurring throughout Season 7, Series 7, sorry, that there's like at some point there's like a little dance rave thing that happens. I'm just like, oh, no, what, why? You know, and the music has never really done that. You know, it's,
is it Howard Goodall on this series, or are they working with someone else? Because
not entirely sure.
When I was watching it, it kept skipping the credits onto the next episode because it's reappeared on Amazon, and that's what Amazon does. And I couldn't work out a way on my new telly to stop it from doing that.
Well, I'm really glad that it's on Amazon, but we'll talk about that next week.
Yes.
So there is a subspace energy disturbance in engineering causing a rip between two dimensions. They go and have a look. The tunnel goes through non-space, which is a void without time, which is what's explained by Crichton. They meet an alternative version of their crew. There's a gold Crichton and a hologrammatic Lister. Lister asks alternative Lister why he wasn't in stasis. What annoyed me about this scene was the alternative cat was completely ignored, including in the extended version.
Apparently, the alternative cat had a deeper voice, but as he doesn't speak in this and they cut all of his lines, we didn't find that out.
Yeah. I will say, the style is something else. He looked the bee's knees.
Yes. Yeah. And so did Hologrammatic Lister as well. He looked banging. He looked hot.
Whereas Crichton looked like he was a, you know, Elvis impersonator with his gold suit.
not the last time we'll see that.
No.
They could have done so much more with both Crichton and Cat, but it was Cat that particularly jarred with me because he just stood there and smiled.
Well, yeah. My notes say Cat doesn't say anything.
Yeah.
No.
Cat. Also, just when they went into the actual gateway into the non-space, it was very Twin Peaks-esque, that music.
Okay.
Yeah, true. A bit
Twins Peaky.
I like Twins Peaky as a term, Kurt.
You could have gone with Bad Lamenti-y.
Bad Lamenti-y, yeah.
It then goes to a flashback for Alternative Lister. And Lister returns from shore leave, which he took to get over being dumped by Kachansky. He's greeted by Rimmer. This was a huge, pleasant surprise for me at the time. I thought we got no more Rimmer. He'd been written out in the first episode, in the second episode, and you were getting no more Rimmer at all for the rest of the series. So when he came back, I remember distinctly having a massive pop for that.
Yeah.
It was a nice surprise as well because it did start the episode like he was completely gone and then suddenly flashback Rimmer, which was...
He went AWOL, not AWOL, he went AWOL. Yeah.
And what I also liked about this scene was that there was like series one and two bickering between the two of them and that they got that right.
Yes.
They got the kind of antagonism right because they had lost that by series six.
Yeah, it tonally very similar with what they were saying, definitely.
And then the joke that I really like was, oh, ha, ha, that great line where he said, people who say, oh, ha, ha, haven't got a witty reply. Oh, ha, ha. And it's just calling someone a bell end.
The pause where he's trying to think of a retort and then goes back to, oh, ha, ha, is what makes it.
So good. Great gag. Great, great gag. And then Kachansky arrives and it's not Claire Grogan. It's Chloe Annett. But my goodness, So, I remember distinctly pretending I fancied Kachansky because I genuinely think Chloe Anna is an incredibly attractive woman. Like, shit a brick. If I was a girl, I'd want to look like Chloe Anna because she's gorgeous. Like, stunning, effortlessly attractive. Bitch.
I'm not going to argue with any of that. She's very nice.
I would like to ask you two, because obviously my opinion is completely irrelevant. Who do you think is genuinely more attractive, Claire Grogan or Chloe Annett?
Chloe Annett.
Series 8, Chloe Annett, definitely. Which then leads me to the point of what I need to say here, is that Series 8 Chloe Annett is more like Chloe Annett in Series 7 before she decided the night before to cut her hair and to dye it. Unfortunately, the dye didn't really take properly, and she's kind of like sort of had it all. The hair and makeup people had a real problem with it. She bought some dye from Sainsbury's or something, and she thought she just wanted to zhush it up a little bit, and it was an absolute nightmare, apparently, including when she came in from like sort of the non-space stuff. It was like a real nightmare.
This is something that none of us will ever have to worry about again.
No.
A bad hair day is for other people.
Got hair on the lower half of my face.
Buy some Sainsbury dye and give it a go, see what you think.
No.
Yeah, let's get it done. And so the new uniforms are a complete contradiction because they should have had the grey uniforms with the ties.
They actually did want to do that on purpose. They actually said because of the things they had in season one and two that they really wanted to like sort of give it a new zhush on it. So,
and you could argue alternative reality.
That was my understanding, that it's an alternate reality, is in that universe, the uniforms were blue.
production-wise, they wanted like just not the colours that they had, which is ironic because in later series we actually go back to that colour, which is a bit of a spoiler, but it's not a massive spoiler. So yeah, so it's ironic that they go back to that. Yeah, and they obviously decide quickly as well in series 8 to go back to that colour as well.
Yeah. So Kochanski refuses to endorse Rimmer's new salute proposal, and he goes off in a huff. She apologises to Lister for dumping him by letter, and they discuss why they broke up, and she wants to be friends. Unfortunately, she's back with her ex. She then discovers Frankenstein and confiscates her.
Can we just say that we just missed the fact that Lister had that card where he said, ring this number and tell him it's an emergency.
Yeah, when she tells him, go have sex with someone, that's an order.
Someone, yeah. Yeah. Here's her number for you, and give it a ring in case of an emergency.
For me personally, if I had to pay for it, I wouldn't want it.
Yeah.
Maybe it isn't someone that pays for it. Maybe it's just someone that's...
Yeah. Yeah, that was...
She's got business cards.
I didn't think it was someone to pay for.
I didn't think it. I think it was just someone who was just loose.
Wow. Kochanski can't bring herself to microwave Frankenstein.
Can we discuss that? Because it's not a microwave, it's a disintegrator, but it's clearly a fucking microwave.
Yes.
And it's not only a microwave, it is a microwave with a Tiger Electronics Lights Out game stuck to the side and painted black. That's what the LED lights are. It was one of them games where... do you remember that Simon game that people used to have where it was like the four lights and you had to press them in the right sequence?
There are four lights. Don't say that. I've got like Pavlov's dog when people say four lights.
It's a similar sort of thing to that.
Only Star Trek people will understand that reference.
I get that. I know that
there is a reference to that, but I don't know what it is because I'm not a fucking Trekkie.
It's even worse when my Google thing, because sometimes when I say like to turn the lights off, it'll go, I've turned off six lights. No, there are four lights, and I talk back to it. But anyway, enough of my ramblings.
Yes. Fucking, if you want to listen to you chat about that, Make It So on the We Made This Podcast Network. Anyway, yeah, she gets put in stasis because it's her that doesn't kill the cat. And it's the same thing that happened to Lister, but it happens to Kochanski because she couldn't bring herself to kill Frankenstein.
Yeah, curiosity would have, though.
And then, with a cheesy, nonsensical reveal, we discover that Kochanski in this reality was the one that survived stasis. And there she is, smouldering. Chloe Annette, I swear to you, she is one of the few women I'd sleep with to make the Hetz upset. She just turns up and smoulders, and I'm like, girl, you be fine.
So anyway, Kochanski turns up. Did we, I'm assuming that you discussed in the previous two episodes the opening credits. So that could have been, in any of the series, that could have been a massive reveal. But they spoiled it two episodes ago.
Lister is mortified about his outfit, and Kochanski isn't impressed. Gold Crichton suggests exchanging supplies. Kochanski asks for Lister to fill a tube with sperm so that she can have kids. That actually makes a lot of sense. That's exactly what you would ask for, isn't it?
It's not what I would ask for, but yeah, that would be the sensible thing.
Well, you'd ask for eggs, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I suppose.
This was not the way I was planning Series 7 to go.
Anyway. A Gelf ship attacks, and they hit the tunnel, and Kochanski falls through the middle. She grabs the strap of Hollow Lister's bag. Our Lister saves her using his dental floss.
That's glued to his teeth.
Yes. They retreat back to the proper reality with Kochanski as the Gelf attack continues. What's upset you, Kurt?
Same problem I had with the last episode. I can't suspend my belief enough in those two, in the two moments of this non-space. I just don't like it. I don't like the floss, and I don't like the harpoon. just don't like it. I am Mr. Grumpy when it comes to those moments. I just can't suspend my belief enough. It's like, no, I'm out of norm jumping forward. But the harpoon, they spend about 35 minutes getting it.
Yeah.
So,
yes.
You know what I mean? So it's like, oh, God. And yeah, this wouldn't work. So anyway, carry on.
No, it would obviously pull his tooth out, but lol.
Or the dental floss.
No, lols.
Don't find it funny. Sorry, guys.
Grumpy Kurt is here to stay.
I know. He is.
Kachansky is in Medibay and is greeted by Lister. She mistakes him for her Lister. He lets her despite Crichton's protestations. This is ick.
Yeah.
It's essentially sexual assault.
Yeah.
It's not okay. It's not funny. And Lister is supposed to be the good guy. He's supposed to be the guy that we like, look up to, and enjoy watching. He explicitly gets sexual favours from someone who isn't in their right mind. It's unforgivable, I'm afraid, for me. It's not okay.
Yeah, it'd be the same as if she was too drunk.
Yeah.
Isn't it exactly the same? Because she's just woken up out of, anaesthetic or whatever.
So what I will say, for the sake of balance, is a few years later, I was going out in gay clubs, and the culture of gay clubs was really fucking unpleasant as well. It is of its time, but this now really, really jars with me. I'm not, I'm not innocent. I've gone home with someone who's grabbed my crotch. You know, someone came up to me in a nightclub, grabbed my crotch. He was good looking, so I went home and had sex with him. So I am not innocent of being in these unpleasantly sexually inappropriate times.
Yeah.
I engaged with that. But now, as an adult in my 40s who understands better, this kind of humour is completely repulsive. And obviously, I would not go home with someone who grabbed my crotch now.
So don't do it, listeners.
I had to take a moment to take myself back to try and enjoy the rest of the episode because this was fucking vile. I don't particularly want to talk about this scene very much.
Fair play. That's all right, yep.
No, fair enough.
Yeah, she calls him out, blah, blah, blah. And then she discovers she's stuck in their reality. And then suddenly they're under attack by the Guelphs who want Lister to honour his marriage to Ech-ech-ech-ech-ech-ech-ech-ech.
Have we finished the episode already?
But yeah, so I love this callback because the Guelphs are one of my favourite things that happen in Red Dwarf. Yeah. I mean, obviously because we end our episodes with the name of Lister's wife. It's just such a element of Red Dwarf that makes me so happy. And this callback is just beautiful. Whatever inspired them to go, Lister's fucking married, we can use that. Perfect.
It's a really bad timing for him.
Yes.
First time he meets Kachansky in millions of years, and his wife turns up. Do you think that the Kinatawawi language was an influence on the... Oh, what are the rhino dudes in Doctor Who?
The Jadoon.
Did they talk like that in old... I don't know if they were in old Doctor Who.
They weren't. The first time they appeared was David Tennant.
I thought it's just Klingon.
Yeah,
I
but there was well, a take on well, Klingon language has more of a structure, doesn't it? Because there's Klingon dictionaries and stuff like that.
I know someone who speaks Klingon.
Yeah,
but I think that's the point. I think it's like, to everyone else, it is just like where it's like kapla, and it's all that kind of thing, which is like a proper language, and they're just using that. Yeah,
I think then from there it probably influenced the Jadoon because their language is like robo shoko po topo sort of thing. That was probably very offensive to any Jadoon listeners. I do apologise. Please don't invade our planet as a result.
Anyway, Kachansky talks tech and it...
I've not looked at the stats. Do we get people from Jadoon that listen to the podcast? Have we got much of a Jadoon demographic?
What are you blithering about?
I'm just thinking we should have a look on Spreaker and see if we've got many Jadonian listeners. And then maybe we should cater a little bit.
We've got some people from interesting countries, but not the moon.
They're not from the moon.
Anyway.
They're from...
They were from the moon in the first episode, weren't they?
I can't remember. Anyway.
I know the ice warriors
were on the moon, weren't they? The hospital was on the moon, wasn't it?
I don't think they're from the moon, though.
No,
temporarily
not
on a base there.
Fucking hell. So, Kachansky talks tech, and it confuses...
Star Trek and Doctor Who. And Twin Peaky. We're doing all right.
Kachansky talks tech.
It's only the first episode as well. We've got another 4 hours of this.
Kachansky talks tech, and it confuses the...
Anyway, Kachansky turns up.
Kachansky talks tech, and it confuses the cat. She has a stylish, piloty way to get out of all the shit that's happening to them, and saves them by making the Gelfs crash. Great stuff. Empowering, positive female role model. Gets called Officer Butt Babe.
Well,
Fuck this.
Yeah, it's Officer BB is what he calls her first of all, because they cut the first... It's Bud Babe. It's not Butt Babe. I always thought it was Butt Babe, but it's Officer Bud Babe.
Oh.
As in, hey, Bud, which is what he says to the others. But yeah, I used to think it was Butt Babe.
Oh, it's less upsetting than I thought it was.
It is less upsetting. Yeah, the first time he calls her that got cut. So then he shortened it to Officer BB, and he calls her that loads before later in the episode it says Officer Bud Babe. And it's like, what the fuck does BB mean? Officer BB King?
BB I mean, Bud? In gay culture, it means something that you shouldn't
do. Right, okay.
Well, unless you're on prep or you know.
Right.
It's short for bareback.
Life's a lesson. Life is a lesson.
Right, okay. Slight piggybacks with no shirt on, yeah?
Exactly that, Colin.
Vladimir Putin on horseback.
That'll upset him.
Crichton and Lister are in their...
I want to say something positive. I do want to say that, like you, Mark, I think that showing Kachansky's aptitude really is good on that. I think it showcases that she's a very, very top officer that knows what she's doing, because we've had these three or four, depending on how you view it, for the last six or seven series, and they are lower decks, if I was to quote a Star Trek term. So the fact that you've got an officer in there that knows what she's doing makes absolute sense.
That's it. They've been busking it, and she actually knows what she's doing. She's probably the biggest asset that they could have.
Yes. Crichton and Lister are in the quarters, and Crichton is doing the ironing. He's upset that Kachansky's there and that she's stuck with them. He's very jealous and concerned that she'll take him away from him. He doesn't believe him when he says that things won't change. And yes, innies and out.
I've seen her naked.
So, this has been something I have quoted ever since, innies and outies. When someone is an attractive woman, I'll say, you're very attractive, but you've got an innie, and what I'm looking for is an outie. This is my quotable red dwarf, is that I use innie and outie to describe man and woman because I'm incredibly childish.
This is a scene that's always stuck in my head with Crichton going, she's going to take you away from me, in that high-pitched voice. That's always, you know, even though I've not watched this episode probably since it was first broadcast, that has always stayed in me noggin.
This scene, and I know it's very, very controversial, depending on who listens or watches it, is either you hate it or you love it. It's definitely a Marmite. And I absolutely love this to bit. This is why I like Crichton. This is the moment that I was like, this is my favourite character. You know, make love to me, you honey dude.
It's the establishment that Crichton is neurotic now, is what this scene is. And the jealousy has always been something I found very, very funny. And I get that people don't like it.
Robert Willellen was talking about this actually as well. And I think it bears talking about, because he talks about like Crichton being asexual and you know, how Red Dwarf was forward thinking in this, because If he was playing a human being, he probably would have been placed as playing a woman doing it, or, you know, inverted commas. But the fact that Crichton is asexual, it is like Lister's mother, or it is like, you know, that kind of neurosis of like an ex-girlfriend or something like that. They're getting heads up about stuff. And
it's an interesting amalgam, isn't it? That it's the ex-girlfriend, it's the mum, it's the best mate. People who are likely to get jealous of someone getting a new partner.
Yeah.
It's a really nicely done, like I say, an amalgam. And I think we don't really see any kind of sexuality towards gender at all from Crichton. So I would probably go as far as saying he's panromantic asexual, in as much as, you know, he has clearly got an emotional attachment to Lister, and it's utterly irrelevant that Lister is a man. It could have as easily been a woman. So, you know, that's panromanticism. But he is definitely asexual because he'd fuck.
Unless it's a vacuum cleaner catalogue or something like that, you know, double Polaroids and all that.
But that was when he was human.
But even among this scene as well, you've got things like... along from the neuroticism, you've got things like, you know, oh, what about the Nova 5? You killed the crew, Crichton. You know, it's like...
Which is a nice establishment that it was actually Crichton that killed them, because that's
I know it's an accident, but nevertheless...
That's never explored in... That isn't gone into in the series previously. That's from the book, because he crashed the Nova 5... by cleaning their Navicomp with soapy water.
And the SS Augustus, is that in the book then? That was the ship before.
I think it might be mentioned in there. Yeah.
Because he says that they died of old age, didn't they? They just died of old age, but the Nova 5, he killed the crew.
So they're back in the cockpit, and Crichton comes...
You're lying!
Good. Crichton comes to lend a hand in the search. Kat tries to impress Kachansky. Kachansky asks Crichton why he doesn't like her. He tells her that she's not good enough for Lister, and then he mocks her walk.
It's another brilliant moment. It's just, it's so funny. And I love the fact this is a great meme on Twitter. You can go on the GIF files and find this moment.
It's like, he walks like a drag queen. He really does walk like a drag queen. Because Chloe Annette does not walk like that.
Kind of that slapstick.
Not noticeably, anyway.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
And just the way it says, well, look at the way you walk. It's like, Crichton's just doing this little hop thing.
Yeah, that was a beautiful moment.
I like the fact that, again, they recall back to it a little bit later as well, where he's like, sort of, he's got the trays of, you know, the wine and stuff, where he's going, where he actually mouths like, she's leaving.
And I mean, they do have a moment where they find a way to get her back, and they high five because they both want her gone. And then he serves champagne, which really made me laugh. And the Crichton Kachansky relationship is one of the best things about Series 7. It really, really is.
Yeah, I do. Both Series 7 and Series 8, I really enjoyed those two together. I think it was a great pairing, and it works well. Like I said with the previous two episodes, the fact that we've got Crichton not being the exposition machine now, and he's actually got, even though some people don't like his neurotic moments, that he's actually got something, he's got some agency on himself, he's got something that's not about, well, we did this, and this is how this works, and that's how that works. He's got this... problem with Kachansky, and the fact that they've got to work together. I think the actual characterization of both of them having to be in the same room together, having that cabin fever together, they have to work together. Really works well, because it's like they both don't like each other, and that moment. I mean, even like the bits where it's like saying, where she's like, you know, she shows off her acting chops by going like, sort of, but why don't you? But you know, and she has to get stopped by Crichton. I think that all of that works perfectly well.
Did you, have you talked in the previous episodes at all about why Kachansky was brought back?
About the film?
Yeah. Did you mention that at all?
Yeah.
And have you talked about the other characters that were potentially going to be brought back instead?
No.
Doug Naylor originally wanted to bring back Captain Hollister was one of the options, who obviously turns up later on, and Peterson. Was who he really wanted to come back, but he decided that having a attractive female lead in there would help them to get a movie.
It was actually the I think it was the actual financiers wanted kind of that.
Right, okay.
More, it was more the case of they wanted a female within the crew.
Yeah.
To finance that film.
Red Dwarf was a sausage fest up until this point, wasn't it?
But if they'd have brought Peterson back, he's just too similar to Lister.
Yeah.
So I don't think that would have been a particularly interesting dynamic at all. And that's what Doug Naylor was, that was his preference apparently, which just seemed really weird. I'm really glad that Kochanski is back in this series. It could have gone horribly, horribly wrong. But I do think that she's a good addition to the series, and she's a fun character that I like.
I'm going to look up when the first Harry Potter film was, because that might have been what actually influenced getting the Peterson actor back.
No.
2001.
No.
Years
later.
What is Harry? Harry what? Sorry, I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh yeah, we don't you know, some turfy bitch wrote some books at one point.
I was obviously ahead of the time because I never watched or read a single line or watched a single frame. So
anyway, Kochanski approaches Lister and he gives her the fertilized test tube. He asks her to let the child know why he's not there, and they discuss his background, how he was abandoned and called both Rob and Ross when he was a kid. They're about to kiss when Crichton interrupts, pretending to dust. Perfect. Love. Lol. Good. Kochanski has tried to make a MacGuffin that means they may be able to have a cross-dimensional communication. Kat brings a box of supplies across from the other crew, and there's a symbol of a snake eating its own tail. Crichton explains that it's an Ouroboros, and Lister has a revelation. He's his own dad, and Kochanski is his mum. Do you want to talk about Ouroboros now?
Well, yeah, we can, but I'm interested in your moment, so I'll let you talk first, because mine's more scientific-based, so...
Just bollocks, innit?
What do you mean, bollocks?
As a sci-fi concept... As a sci-fi concept, it's fucking wretched.
It's causality determination. A causal determination is what it is.
It's bullshit.
Like Lost, for example, right? In Lost, there's a pocket watch.
Oh, don't talk about Lost.
Richard gives to Locke in 2007, but then Locke gives it back to Richard in 1954. So where did that compass come from? Because there's no determination on it.
Script writer.
This is slightly different in the fact that, you know, we know the birth of, but it's like we still quite can't, you can't quite fathom out what came first, the chicken or the egg kind of thing. But that's a sci-fi trope all the way through. So I don't have any problems with that whatsoever.
So the idea is that the reason they do it is so that humanity can never become extinct. Because if you kill Lister, his son, who is Lister, is still there. But if you kill... So...
Yeah, exactly.
Simplifying it... If we simplify it down...
Yeah.
It's 2022 now. If we go with somebody has a kid in 2022, then goes back to 1995 and leaves the kid there to grow up to become them. But if that person is then killed in 2024... Technically, their kid is still there, but the kid doesn't go past that point because they've been killed. So surely the human race can become extinct.
It can become extinct post the year that they go back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's only a loop in the time frame of the actual going back in time.
So it's not true that it can never become extinct, which is what they said the reason for doing it was.
I think, yeah, but it depends on if you're talking philosophy in this way, you'd have to put an if-then statement. So you'd have to say that that human race could not become extinct from that particular date. So from that, the 3 million years, it would be a case of like, it can't become extinct back in 2196 or whatever it might well be.
Right. Okay. So it, yeah. I'm glad this isn't the second episode we're recording tonight.
Because things like causal determination as well is the fact that you can go down a rabbit hole with this, with, like, you know, philosophy and all kinds, you know, Greek legends and all kinds. Because there's a classic Greek legend, I can't remember who it was because there's loads of them, like Leucippus and all these kind of people, where there's like a determination or fatalism, I think it is. I might get my words mixed up because I haven't done it for a while. But basically that this person is told that their determination, predestination is going to be that they are going to sleep with their mother and kill their father.
Oedipus.
So what happens? Oedipus. Is it Oedipus? Yeah. Oedipus, yeah. So that what happens there is that he leaves his adopted father, who doesn't realise, kills the father completely coincidentally, and then falls in love with the mother, but doesn't realise it's the mother too afterwards. And so that's predestination's already happened. It's all about whether or not you've got free will. Right. There's that kind of element to it. But what I like about these kind of like discussions that you can have with this one in particular is that Lister going back to taking, putting Lister back into the Agba Farms, he mentions in this episode, it says if he drifted through his childhood, he wasn't sure who his mother and father was. If he'd not done that, if he was grown up in a separate way, he wouldn't have ended up on Red Dwarf. He wouldn't have been a technician in the way that he is, and he wouldn't have ended up being as empathetic as he is, and then saving the cat and then ended up where he is at the moment. Yeah. So there's an element of like that kind of element, and I love those kind of thought
experiments.
Experiments, yeah, because I think it's just to think about that. I can think about that literally for an age. And going back to the Ouroboros thing, this was aired in what, January 97?
Yep.
The X-Files spin-off show, Millennium.
Yes, of course.
It's the Millennium symbol is an Ouroboros, and that came out in December 1996. So talking about coincidence, which doesn't happen. you know, that I was watching Millennium at the time. We had this Ouroboros, and then, like, literally a month later, there's, like, an episode of Red Dwarf, and I'm watching it, and it's like, oh, that's an Ouroboros.
So did you get it from the start of the episode, then? Did you say...
I wouldn't have got it from an aspect of thinking about the concept of it, but I literally instantly went, that says Ouroboros.
Yeah.
You know, I knew it was kind of like a circle of life, well, not like an apocalypse is what the Ouroboros is in Millennium. It's like the coming apocalypse. It's the end of the world to start again. Kind
right.
of thing. So I kind of got that, but...
Like a phoenix kind of thing.
Yeah, I wouldn't have really clicked onto it as an intelligent human being when I was 16, 17. I would have just gone, oh, look at that. There's the Ouroboros symbol. It says, oh, Roboros.
So, it also gets... Ouroboros gets mentioned somewhere, although I'm not quite sure what it means because I've just seen it in passing... in Assassin's Creed Valhalla, which I've just recently started playing. But I have no idea what it has to do with the plot or anything yet. I think it's a symbol that goes back as far as Norse sort of mythology, basically.
It's also an overdone tattoo that is nearly as bad as one of those feathers with the birds flying out of it.
Dana Scully got an Ouroboros on her back, and then magically in season 8, it disappears.
Uh-huh. Cat. Lister chases Kachansky, asking her to return the in vitro tube.
Yeah, and he shouts, the Gelfs Mom!
Yes, he does. That's not what you want to...
No.
That's not what you want your ex to start calling you, is it? And the Gelfs attack once more, and Kachansky ends up on the wrong side of the tunnel again. This time, she's not having it, so she attempts to jump. Unfortunately, she fails to make it and falls. Kachansky phones Lister and asks him to save her life using the mountaineering equipment they now have courtesy of a trade. And you already complained about something I was going to mention, Kurt. It just takes them so damn long, she'd be lost forever.
But it's non-space, where time doesn't exist.
Yeah, well, I know, and I knew you were going to say that as well, because I've got it in my notes saying, yes, all right, there's an explanation potentially, but she's falling forever, and it's some shot as well.
Yeah.
Because there is a lot of rope that goes, so I get what they were trying to get at. And to be fair, I do think the obscene phone call is
hilarious. That's the funniest bit in the episode, is where she phones back, Crichton answers it, and you see the look on his face, and goes, "It's an obscene phone call. I think it's for you, sir." That's my favourite bit of the episode.
And then Lister's face when it's like...
I also very much like Kachansky's "bastard" when she gets shot in the leg.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's an excellent bit of exclamation.
Let's say it works. Back in medbay, Crichton brings Kachansky a drink. They confirm that the rip is repaired and she can't get back ever. Kachansky leaves medbay and she has her gown tucked accidentally into her knickers. Rather than tell her, Crichton just welcomes her aboard.
Mom, welcome aboard. I do find that funny. I just love the cheekiness of Crichton's face.
I think as ways of getting a character into the main cast of a series like Red Dwarf, if it was done today, this would be like, another alternative reality plot. But I don't think that was the case in 1997. I think alternative realities were relatively, well, they were certainly less overdone compared to now.
Yeah, I think Star Trek would do alternate realities, but it'd be one episode. Not like, you know, it'd be like the Enterprise C comes up because of some sort of time and cause effect issue. There'd be like sort of, you know, the mirror universe in the original series, but they're always like one-offs and not really, they don't affect the plot or anything like that at all. They don't bring anyone new in. I think probably Star Trek Next Generation was the first one I can think of. I mean, there's bound to be others, but where Tasha Yar died. But again, and I think this happens in TV shows quite a lot, where something happens. I mentioned Lost before, and I'll mention Star Trek and X-Files in this. Gillian Anderson got pregnant. They needed to do something with her story. They made her get abducted in the second season. Yep. You know, and it became so important to the X-Files mythology because it became the main thing that thrust the TV show into the stratosphere in the 90s. Star Trek, Tasha Yar, there was multiple issues on set and things like that that she didn't survive the first season, but she came back later on with a different cast and crew. Well, not different cast, but different crew on board and all that type of thing. And she came back as someone else, which managed to do some sci-fi, timey-wimey kind of things. So having those and Lost, there was a couple of people who are quite famous now who you know, were caught with DUIs in America, and the crew of Lost basically kind of sacked them and got rid of them via the show, and then used that as an impetus for the show. So there's moments like that that kind of work quite well, but obviously this is like going back to the whole story of the film and things, but it is an interesting way to do it, and I think Next Generation is probably the clue.
Yeah, it's a trope called do you ever go on the TV Tropes website?
I do go on the TV Tropes. I don't really read, I only read stuff that I'm like searching for, though. When I see it, I'll go on TV Tropes there. So
that's very sensible, because you can get lost for days in there if you just start reading stuff. But there's a trope on there called Real Life Writes the Plot, and that would be sort of those. The next episode, there's an example of that as well that I've got noted, but I'll talk about that next week.
So, Lister ports into the bar from the opening scene in the cold open, and he's got himself as a baby 18 months later. He tells baby Lister that the paradox they're creating will mean the human race will never be extinct. But we've discussed that already. Very quickly looking at the extended, we get the theme tune. And there is a pretty funny scene, actually, where the cat is being very vain. It wasn't necessary, so it was probably right to cut it, but I quite liked it.
Because it's more cat.
Yeah, and he doesn't get much in this episode. Absolutely right.
Yeah.
One thing I did notice was there wasn't a Stoke Me a Clipper extended episode. In my memory, there were extended episodes of all of them.
Good.
Is it that the DVD's missing the extended of Stoke Me a Clipper, or did there never exist a Stoke Me a Clipper extended?
There was only select episodes.
Right.
There were only select episodes.
So my memory's wrong then. I mean, when you think about it, 1997 is what, 25 years ago? No wonder my memory's shaky. No wonder my memory's shonky. Because, you know, I don't remember what I had for tea last night. Well, I do. It was vegetable pie. But you know what I mean. I also had a quick listen to the commentary, and they confirm, like you said, that it was Danny John-Jules' nephew. And these commentaries were recorded in 2006, but they still have Chloe Anna, even though she'd kind of fucked off by that point. And I actually really liked having Chloe on the commentaries because it had always just been the original four up to this point. And they confirm exactly why we don't have Chris Barry. And we thought it was Britas. It's not.
It's too late for Britas, isn't it?
Yeah. He's doing Lara Croft.
Of course.
Mm. So yes. That's why we don't have Rimmer in this series, or we have limited Rimmer in this series, is because he got a big gig in the States being a badass butler.
I've not seen the film. Does he get locked in the fridge?
Oh, it's been forever since I've seen it. I just remember Chris Barry being badass was a highlight of the film.
I just remember playing the Tomb Raider game, and one of the things that you can do is lock the butler in the fridge. So, yeah.
All right. Okay. I don't remember playing too much of Tomb Raider. I played the new Tomb Raider games, you know, the reboot, but I don't remember playing too much of the originals. Wasn't it more of a PlayStation exclusive?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, so hence the reason why I didn't play them, because I was a Sega boy.
But yeah, so this episode is massively flawed. There are some unsalvageably offensive jokes about stuff we don't want jokes about. But there's a lot to like about it as well, I think. Any final thoughts from either of you two on the episode?
I think for me, it's similar to last episode. I think this is where I kind of was like, Series 7 isn't really like doing it for me in the way it used to be, like Red Dwarf used to be. And it's like what you said, and like I said last week, there's moments I absolutely really like and really adore and think it's brilliant, and then there's moments that like kind of like really draw it down. I think there's less of that in here than there was last week. Last week I have problems with big chunks. This week I have problems with three elements.
I would say the exact opposite of that. This is probably my least favourite. But yeah, I can see how you, Stoke Me a Clipper, I absolutely get your opinion on it. It doesn't bother me, whereas the stuff in this does bother me. So they're not weak episodes, but they've got stuff that we both kind of dislike to different levels that are really obvious things to dislike. What about you, Colin? What do you think?
I think it's all worth it for that obscene phone call joke. But no. Yeah, it's not going to be in your top however many episodes we've watched so far. It's better than fucking Body Swap. Was it Body Swap that we hated?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's better than that. It's not as good as anything in Series 5 or 6, I don't think. But
hell no.
But it was still way better than I remembered it being and expected it to be. And I do think that Chloe Arnett does a really good Kochansky. If you think about if you counted up the minutes that Claire Grogan had been in previously.
Yes.
Chloe Arnett's probably just in this one episode been in it longer than Claire Grogan. She wouldn't have had half an hour over the previous six series, I don't think.
People still seem to think to some extent that Claire Grogan is the definitive Kochansky. I disagree completely. Chloe Annette was great in the role. I really think that. And particularly on the rewatch of the entire series, I think she's a very capable comedic actor. She's great.
Yeah.
And she's fit.
Well, just based on going back to the whole, like, you know, alternate realities, bringing people in, she's English, you know, Claire Grogan was Scottish. They did that in Star Trek 2009. Alice Eve's character was American, Marcus, and she was English in Star Trek 09. So, you know, Red Dwarf was just ahead of the game, as far as I'm concerned.
The character's still Scottish, though, because she talks about her upbringing in Glasgow in the next episode.
I think, to some extent, that's a nice little nuance, in as much as she is from Glasgow, but she speaks with RP, and posh people from Glasgow probably would behave like that, you know.
Are there posh people in Glasgow?
Well, people who want to be posh in Glasgow.
I think they all just move to Edinburgh, don't they?
Well, true. But received pronunciation is exactly what it says on the tin. It's a received pronunciation. No one talks like that unless they explicitly want to. So, in my head canon, that actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, that's fair.
Right, well, that was a odd episode of Red Dwarf. I definitely think so. And I still enjoy chatting about it, even if it's not a favourite of mine. Kurt, where can people find you on that there interwebs?
On the Twitter sphere at rmuldrake, rmuldrake. You can find all my podcasts on that Twitter feed, and you can also find my YouTube channel on there as well. If you type in rmuldrake, you'll find that on my YouTube feed as well. But yeah, that's the best place to find me, and no doubt I can guarantee you that when this comes out that my other YouTube channel will be on screen as well. So have a look for that. And look at my Twitter.
Gosh. And you've run a metric fuck ton of podcasts, many more than I am these days. Colin, where can people find you on that there internet?
So I've got two other podcasts, We Dig Music and Through This Month's Issue. Through This Month's Issue is a podcast where we talk about old free magazine CDs from stuff like Kerrang, Enemy, Metal Hammer, that sort of thing. And you can find that by searching for it on podcast apps. It's on Twitter as at This Month's Issue. And my other podcast, We Dig Music, is where me, Ian from Through This Month's Issue, and our friend Tracy go through a different year each month, choose our 10 favourite songs each, and then fight about it. And I usually win because I have the best music taste. And you can find that at We Dig Music PCast, although it's a podcast, search for it. That is the best way to do it. And yeah, if you want to find just me on Twitter, I am Mogwai Fear Satan.
If you're looking for me, it's at Mark Adams HC on Twitter. I only have two active podcasts at the moment, this one and Chucky Vision. Chucky Vision being that we made this show about the Chucky and or Child's Play franchise. My friend Dev and I are working our way through the teleseries in October. But in the meantime, we're doing random monthly episodes about, well, basically like the specials on this, where we pick a random thing slightly linked to the Chucky franchise and we have a chat about it. We've done some fun episodes of that. We've looked at all the films as well. If you like horror, if you like Chucky, please do give that a listen because I'm having the best time doing that.
I heard there's a good one of those where you talk about the soundtrack to Bride of Chucky.
We did a crossover with Free With This Month's Issue and it was great. I loved that episode.
It's fun.
That's it for this week. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week with Ducked Soup. And until then,
you're lying!
Hello everyone, this is Tony Black, co-host and producer of You Have Been Watching, a podcast all about British sitcoms. Myself and co-host Robert Turnbull take you on a range of Britcom subjects and shows in our discussions, including greats such as Fawlty Towers.
Basil, in the same way as David Brent and Alan Partridge and Victor Meldrew, Basil works best when he is actually dealing with assholes.
Lesser known curios such as 15 Stories High.
There are all these kind of like gag setups being put in place in that episode, and then the sort of the end like minute or so is basically the payoff to all of these gags, and it's very, very sitcom-y.
And even top tens such as sitcom theme tunes. If we have to put composers of theme tunes in context for British sitcoms, I think Ronnie Hazelhurst he's possibly the John Williams of...
I was just going to say, he is the John Williams of British sitcom.
We're available on all podcast platforms and on social media at YHB Watching Pod on Twitter and Facebook. So please subscribe, get in touch, and come and have a laugh with us.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast, was created and produced by Mark Adams and Kurt North. You can find us on Twitter at Red Dwarf Pod, and we are part of the We Made This Podcast Network, which can be found online at wemadethispod.com or on Twitter at WeMadeThisPod.